Sixth Hour, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for March 18th, 2018, a special pre-primary election edition of the Sunday Spin with Election Day on Tuesday. Thank you, as always, for being with us for our weekly look inside the world of politics and policy, where we'll take you from City Hall to Springfield and all the way out to Washington, D.C. So, yes, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. Well, final frenetic week of campaigning before the final ballots are cast and counted, and we'll be talking much more about it on the show ahead. But it always seems strange to come to work on St. Patrick's Day before an election. All the revelers are out in force. Well, it's just another work day for me. And I can tell you what kind of, yesterday was just, sidewalks were jammed, but the kind of the final irony is this morning at the front door of Tribune Tower, the revolving door, as I pushed the door to go outside to check the temperature, I had to push through a couple of broken beer bottles. Okay.
And it's, are you surprised by that?
No. You know, I'm surprised I haven't seen more of a mess. Normally, coming down here about 5 in the morning, there are still people wandering the streets. There were still people wandering the streets. But then there are also the ones that are passed out on Lower Michigan Avenue.
Know, I didn't see anybody.
I didn't either.
Or any, anything, any debris, let's put it that way.
Oh, I saw plenty of debris.
On the way in this morning.
Yes.
I didn't. It was rather clean. But I think the overriding question, Rick, is I must ask this yesterday regarding everything going on outside. Was our musician entertainer friend there?
Of course he was. playing Danny Boy 6 notes at a time. Oh, it was dreadful.
I can only imagine him trying to play Danny Boy.
It was absolutely dreadful. Just dreadful.
That's a new one.
And of course, it's like, and the tourists were actually putting money in his bucket.
Oh, I've seen that. I saw it last week.
And it's like, don't feed the trolls, please.
I saw it last week. He just got done playing the 12 Days of Christmas.
6 notes at a time. Oh. And
6 Days of Christmas for him.
And to top it off, he was, after he'd play 6 notes, he was actually trying to sing. On top of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Johnny Six Note was
all
actually
these
trying
years,
to.
Years, I've never heard him sing.
Oh, it goes right along with this
with
music.
With the sax playing.
Oh, just awful.
Have you seen this person, Andy?
I have not. I have not had the pleasure.
Oh, it's well.
Go down there about 11
o'clock. He takes over as I call it, the planter outside Tribune Tower. I call it the Tree of Knowledge.
It is the Tree of Knowledge,
and he takes over that planter.
Okay,
and plants there. And plays a saxophone 6 notes at a time because he can't play a whole song, and none of the notes are on key.
Okay,
I was pleasantly surprised the other day. Actually, someone else was down there, an elderly person with an accordion, and was very good and had gloves on. Now, play the accordion with gloves.
That's tough.
That's a unique talent.
It's tough.
But actually, he was very good, and he wasn't loud, and he hit the notes, you know. I mean, he did the kind
of thing. At least he was playing some sort of appealing music.
Yeah, then. Something substantive. And he wasn't playing Lady of Spain or something like that, you know. But it was actually very pleasant. But then, yesterday, on top of all of the goofs out filling up the sidewalks, there was Johnny Six Note. So I walked around to Pioneer Court over here, where the lovely Walk of Fame is. This is like 10 o'clock yesterday morning, and there was a line of 40 people waiting to get into Howells and Hood, the bar and restaurant here at Tribune Tower. 40 people waiting to get in line at 10 o'clock in the morning, and they had their outdoor beer garden was open, and it was full.
Hmm.
Okay? So it's like, I got to get my work done, and I got out of here about 3:30, 4 o'clock yesterday because I wanted to get back to see the Loyola game. And you couldn't take a bus. I mean, the only buses really that were running were the buses going to and from Union Station, because we had to have more people downtown and also to get them back on the trains.
What about the State Street bus?
Well, I didn't even bother. I went straight to the Red Line. And thank goodness I was heading southbound, because the northbound trains, oh, it was worse than any Cubs game. I mean, it was,
Maybe part of that had to do with the Loyola game. People wanting to go up there to the area there.
Well, and actually, and I did talk to a number of people, when I got home and went over to one of my favorite places, and Cafe Bianda, and watching the game there. And there were a couple of people there, and they were heading up to Loyola to buy gear.
Oh, were they?
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing team. And Andy, I told you, they're my Cinderella pick. I knew they could get I knew they'd get through the first round, even though it took a miracle three-pointer at the buzzer to do it. But that was tremendous. But yesterday, I mean, even though, you know, it was still the one-pointer at the end, there was just something inevitable about that win yesterday.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a very experienced team. I've had a chance to call a couple of their games in the regular season this year. And over the past couple of years, in getting to know Porter Moser a little bit, their head coach, this is a guy that is truly moving 100 miles an hour all the time with his hair on fire. But there's a message. You know, I mean, there's a meaning to all of it. And, you know, their shirts, if you notice on the TV broadcast, created by culture. That's really big in West Rogers Park. That's what they're holding their hats to, because they have developed a nice culture. They have developed a real good, solid team that, you know, has a hero or night. I mean, it was Dante Ingram the other night, and it was Clayton Custer yesterday, and, you know, now they're on to the Sweet 16 for the first time since they were last in the tournament as well back in 1985. And they'll face the winner today of Nevada and Cincinnati. That'll be in Atlanta coming up on Thursday.
Sweet 16. I mean, how about it?
It's awesome.
And as you said, developing the culture kind of thing. Because now, granted, you make it to the Sweet 16, that's a recruiting tool like anything.
Huge.
But on top of that is the fact that they are still a relatively young team. I think they have two seniors.
Two big ones. I mean, three.
Okay.
Andre Jackson, Dante Ingram, and who am I forgetting? Ben Richardson.
So, I mean, this is a team that could well be back. I mean,
Definitely.
And it's not to take anything away from them as they go forward.
No, not at all.
But they could well be back. And it was just fun to kind of tune out the politics a little bit and all of the commercials, although they were still running the commercials in the game. But to tune that out and just kind of sit back, chill, and just watch some great basketball. And like I said before, I'm not a great college basketball fan during the regular season, because there's a million teams and a million games and all of that. But tournament time, when it's one and done, and these kids are giving everything.
Yeah, they're giving everything. It was an incredible finish to that game as well, with a really fortunate bounce off the back.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And then off the glass and then down. It was also interesting just to kind of be out and about yesterday watching some games in local watering holes, and just watching the kind of battle going on between the St. Patrick's Day Revelers and the NCAA Revelers. Some of them were one of each and didn't have a real issue with the tournament games being put on and the sound being put full in the bar. But there were a couple of people yelling, "We want music, we want music." And then we're thinking,
it's the tournament.
This is the NCAA tournament, guys.
Right.
Go somewhere else for your music.
Yeah, trust me, there are other options available,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Make your own music in your head. I'm sure you're hearing lots of songs.
Oh, I'm sure they were hearing things in their head.
They could have come down here to hear Johnny.
Yeah, they could have come down here to the Tree of Knowledge and hear Johnny Six Note. Yeah, that would have been pleasant.
I have to hear him sing.
Oh, no.
No. I'm going to make a request later today. If he's out there,
stop playing. You know what? He's all yours, okay, Dave? You can him. But, you know, speaking of the tournament, UMBC.
Oh, that's awesome.
Now, I had to get on my phone. I mean, Friday night, when I got done with work late, And I'm sitting with a friend, and we're watching. And he, you know, it was like 10 minutes left to go in the second half, and they're up by 20 points.
Yeah.
And he's going, "Are you watching this?" And I said, you know, and I'm kind of drifting in and out of it and talking with other people. And I'm going, well, 10 minutes. I'm figuring Virginia is going to make the inevitable run, second half, whatever. And then 5 minutes to go, then a minute to go.
Yeah.
And it's UMBC by 20 points.
Easily, yeah.
And I had to Google to find out what UMBC was.
You didn't know it was University of Maryland, Baltimore County?
I had no idea.
And you didn't know their nickname was the Retrievers?
I learned about the Retrievers. But what conference is that?
That is the South, I want to say, but I'll check that.
But I assume that's how they got in.
They did. They beat Vermont on a buzzer beater to get into the tournament.
They were a playing team?
They had to win their game in their conference.
In the conference.
To get the automatic bid. So if that ball doesn't go in, everybody's doing this revisionist history kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, for the first time in 136 tries, 16 beat the one.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel for Virginia because, you know, Tony Bennett's a pretty good coach. And this is going to follow him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, I mean, because it's history.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolute history, and not in a good way.
No.
But I will tell you, I did see the post-game interview, and he is a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Just as gracious as you would want
mm-hmm.
in a situation that is just so devastating in a career. You know,
I mean,
just a first-class guy. And this is why it's the tournament, you know? This is why it's fun.
People have been waiting for this for years.
Yeah, and to think that it never happened is just unbelievable. More games today.
Yes, sir.
More fun to watch, and the tournament is a great distraction away from the Blackhawks.
I thought we weren't going to talk about this today.
I still have the hat on.
Yeah, you do.
But I truly, I mean, also, I would say the election is also a distraction from mm-hmm. the Blackhawks because yeah. it wasn't until Dave sent me a note saying, sorry about the Hawks, that it even dawned on me. I knew they were playing, but I didn't even have a chance to pay attention. And I'm sorry, but giving up 5 goals to Buffalo.
Yeah, losing to Buffalo.
Losing to Buffalo. But giving up 5 goals is just, you know.
Well, this game was another one of those microcosms of the way the season has gone. You can't hold third period leads, and we have been so used to over the years the third period charge and the quick answer to goals that would go against them. I mean,
right.
It seemed like 15, 20 seconds later, the Hawks were scoring a goal to
answer
either tie it or go back ahead.
Yep.
It just hasn't happened. And it's, you know, for whatever reason, a lot of these guys, and we don't like to make excuses, we're not in that business, but, you know, there's guys that have logged a lot of miles as far as hockey's concerned over their careers, and they're still young guys, but they have logged tons and tons of ice time minutes.
Yes, yes.
And it's kind of, I think I told you this a couple weeks ago, it's a team in transition because there's a lot of the older guys that are still contributing and playing well. But you have to get a younger group together, and you know, with Alex DeBrincat and Nick Schmaltz and those kind of guys, that Eric Gustafson and those types of players are starting to get more meaningful minutes. They haven't translated into wins right now, but it's experience going into next year.
Absolutely, and truly, that is the thing about hockey. I think, as I've said before, that people forget they're on skates. Okay,
oh, yeah.
But also it's about having fresh legs. You know, part of the reason why I'm not so big on shootouts to end games and things, and why Stanley Cup doesn't have them, is kind of that attrition factor of during a game. And it's about the conditioning and about a full season and just being able to put on a good shift with, you know, young, active legs. And even if they're not necessarily young, mm-hmm. Just knowing how to condition yourself and be in the right place. You know, it's not always, it's where the puck is going to be. It's not where it is.
Yeah, anticipation.
You know? And that's the trick of the sport.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they play St. Louis tonight.
Right.
And, let's go Hawks.
If
you're going to win, please do me a favor.
Beat the Blues.
Beat the Blues, please. gosh, takes me back to those days when I was a stringer for UPI at the Checker Dome.
Oh, yeah, I remember the Checker Dome.
The old Checker Dome in St. Louis Blues games.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, before we had laptop computers and all of the media tools that we have, the technology available. And I remember this game, and so I was dictating to Kansas City my game story.
On a landline phone.
On a landline phone. Plus, I had to dictate the agate, you know, the fine type stuff. 256 minutes in penalties.
Oof.
It took me longer to dictate the agate than it took me to dictate the game story.
Less words.
And I got called in to the office in St. Louis the next day by the editor, the UPI editor in St. Louis. And I said, Laz, what, you know, is there a problem? He goes, I just have some questions. He goes, what's floor checking? I said, what? He goes, what's floor checking? I said, no, it's floor checking.
Floor checking, yes.
Well, how come your story says floor checking? I said, it did? And then there was another question of a similar nature. And, of course, it turns out the guy that I was dictating the story to had no concept in Kansas City of what hockey was.
Oh, that's great.
And I just said, you know what? Can I just call Chicago and dictate from now on? Because they at least know what a hockey game is.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's beat the Blues. Just a little payback would be nice. Well, Dave's here to keep us up on all the news. Andy's got the latest sports. Producer Casera's here to field your phone calls. 312-981-7200. That's our text line as well. Engineer Bob is still checking his brackets to see if he's got any teams going on here. You can find all of our shows on WGNradio.com. You can get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. Up ahead, we'll be speaking to my good friend and colleague Hal Dardick from the Tribune. We'll be talking about the Cook County Assessor's race and the fate of Cook County Assessor Joe Berrios. And then after the 8 o'clock news and sports update, we're going to have a special roundtable with my good friend Bob Sector from the Better Government Association and Chris Mooney from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs as we talk about all the races coming up on Tuesday's ballot. And please give us a call if you have any questions about any of these races. Once again, 312-981-7200. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. The turmoil continuing inside the Trump administration. The president used Twitter to dump Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. But Trump's favored replacement, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, faces a difficult confirmation. Here's the president speaking about both Tillerson and Pompeo.
Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things. When you look at the Iran deal, I think it's terrible. I guess it was okay. I wanted to either break it or do something, and he felt a little bit differently. So we were not really thinking the same. With Mike Pompeo, we have a very similar thought process. I think it's going to go very well.
He thinks it's going to go very well, but stay tuned on that front when it comes to Senate confirmation. Meanwhile, Tillerson gave a brief thank you to the nation.
Importantly, to the 300 plus million Americans, thank you for your devotion to a free and open society, to acts of kindness towards one another, to honesty, and the quiet hard work that you do every day to support this government with your tax dollars. All of us, we know, want to leave this place as a better place for the next generation. I'll now return to private life as a private citizen, as a proud American, proud of the opportunity I've had to serve my country. God bless all of you. God bless the American people. God bless America.
And notably, no thank you to the President of the United States. Well, joining us now on the show, is my good friend Hal Dardick, my seatmate, cubicle mate, up on the fourth floor of Tribune Tower. He is a city and county government reporter at the Chicago Tribune. And, of course, he has been writing extensively about the race for Cook County Assessor. And, you know, Hal, when you think about the office of assessor, it's normally not one that gets a whole lot of attention, but boy, is it getting attention now.
Yeah, that's for a number of reasons this year. One is because of the tax divide story that the Tribune and ProPublica Illinois collaborated on that showed that the way Joe Barrios' office assesses property shifts the tax burden from the wealthy to the poor in kind of a reverse Robin Hood type of result there. And people have reacted to that in the minority communities, which is bearing a lot of that burden by, in some ways, abandoning Barrios. But it's gained a lot of traction. The other reason that this race has gained so much attention is because Joe Barrios, of course, is the Cook County Democratic Party chairman, an ally of House Speaker Mike Madigan, and folks think if Joe Barrios gets in trouble in an election and perhaps loses, that it could be an indication of weakness in the old guard political Democratic organization in both Chicago and Cook County, and maybe even the state. So, and thirdly, the gubernatorial candidates, Chris Kennedy in particular, has made it an issue in the campaign about fairness and minority communities and the so-called Madigan machine. So it's really gotten quite a high profile. And of course, there's been all the twists and turns in the race that have made it.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, it made me a busy guy.
So. Yes. Well, and I think what we're seeing here, and obviously we know how Bruce Rauner, as governor, Republican governor, has spent millions of dollars, even before he took office, demonizing Mike Madigan. And we're seeing Barrios, in some respects, bearing that same kind of demonization in this campaign.
Absolutely. The folks, the more independent, self-styled progressive folks in the Democratic Party have made him the bogeyman, if you will. He's the guy that, okay, look at the machine, if you will, although it's not as much of a machine as it once was, but the old guard machine.
The establishment.
Yes, yeah, that's the right word. So if you look at the establishment, they're harming minorities. And so he's become the symbol for that because of what's going on with the property tax assessments and how unfair that burden is. And that's pretty objective thing to say at this point. I mean, usually you got to say, well, the study found or this or that, but it was even corroborated by the county's own study that Joe Barrios collaborated with. Of course, he pledges to fix it, but folks say, well, you've been in office for 8 years. Why haven't you fixed it yet? And Fritz Kagi, the main challenger, is saying he'll fix it from day one. And there's and we talk about the twists and turns. Andrea Ralla was placed back on the ballot just last week after like 100,000 early votes were already cast, and so now it's a three-way race on Tuesday.
Yeah, and I mean, the fascinating thing about that, as you point out, you already have 100,000 early votes counted, and there were signs in the polling place saying if you cast a vote for her, it's not going to count.
Right. There were notices. If you got a mail-in ballot, you were given a notice with the mail-in ballot. They were posted in the polling places. And probably all the candidates' biggest nightmare, and mine too, perhaps, is that when all this is said and done, Andrea Ralla could go into court if she doesn't win, which doesn't seem terribly likely at this point, and say, we should have a special election, a do-over, if you will, because of the way that that worked out.
And the precedent that that could set as well. I mean, we don't do do-overs normally. But again, you know, on the ballot, off the ballot, off the ballot, off the ballot, now on the ballot. And now you have that dynamic as we, you know, enter into the real voting day of Tuesday. We're speaking with Hal Dardick, my good friend and colleague, county government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined on the phone by Hal Dardick, my cubicle mate and colleague on the fourth floor of Tribune Tower, who's a city and county government reporter. And we're talking about the race for Cook County Assessor. And Hal, earlier you kind of touched on this, and obviously the fact that it's Joe Berrios is not just assessor, but he's also the Cook County Democratic chairman. And we've seen this kind of confluence of events. Yes, we had the tax divide series about issues about inequities in assessment of property and who bears the burden for things. But you also kind of have this issue of property taxes in general. This is kind of a year of, I don't want to say property tax revolt, but it's certainly on everybody's mind. And then you have this whole kind of the anti-establishment, the insurgency kind of campaign going on within the Democratic Party. And this whole confluence of events just seems to be symbolized by the Cook County Assessor's race.
Yeah, it certainly is, and it's something that has become sort of a test point for the progressives. If we can win this race, which, you know, it is a down ballot contest, and people don't know a lot about the assessor, but it's a really important office, you know, because it determines how the tax burden is divided. So if they can win this, it would be sort of a way for them to say we can win these big races and move forward and maybe win more. I also think that the other factor here that I forgot to mention earlier is how certain people in the Democratic Party, Mike Madigan, City Council Alderman Ed Burke, profit from the property tax assessment system by having law firms that make appeals, and if they win these appeals on these large commercial properties, they get substantial payments to their law firms. And interestingly enough, we did a quick look at Joe Berrios's campaign contributions, and in the past year or so, about four-fifths of them came from those property tax appeal attorneys. He interestingly went to court and tried to strike down county limits that he had been cited for exceeding on those contributions. So he brought some attention to this broader issue, the allegations from the progressives that Madigan and others are sort of gaming the system to their own personal financial advantage. So if they can break, you know, and Fritz Kagi and Andrea Relatua pledged not to take that money from folks involved in the appeals industry. So if you can break that down, you're sort of striking at the heart of a financial way that the establishment, some of the leading establishment folks have profited. So that is another reason why it's a progressive touch point.
Well, and on top of that, I've talked to some, you know, long-time people in the city and that are politically active, and they're kind of saying, too, that, you know, with Berrios, developers, real estate people, they know what they're getting, and they know the game, and that it's kind of an understood thing, and that's what's helped make Chicago and all the new development that we have here. And if Berrios loses, then the game has changed. And that understanding no longer kind of exists, that there might be, you know, well, I got a guy kind of thing. But if Berrios loses, that's all out the window.
Yeah, that's it is. It is. Ostensibly, if everyone lives up to their campaign pledges, right?
Right.
So if it is out the window, it changes the way things work in the city. And certainly big-time developers are used to that. They may be fearful, I would imagine, that they will see higher commercial assessments. The tax divide touched on that too, and it seems like a number of those commercial assessments may not be as high, and that's the cost of doing business in the city of Chicago. It could create a level of uncertainty among folks that have for better or worse, depending on your point of view, come to work within this system and feel some level of comfort. Businesses like certainty, right?
Yeah, right. And well, and then that's the private sector, but then too, as we said, Berrios being the Cook County Democratic chairman and ally of Speaker Madigan, then you would have, you know, kind of an upheaval within the Cook County Democratic organization. And, you know, we kind of go back a year ago, and it's like, you want the county Democratic organization's endorsement if you're running for office. You want the establishment endorsement. And here again, we come into this wave where it's, you know, against the establishment.
Right, right. Interesting enough, Chris Kennedy sought that endorsement, didn't he?
Right. Well, yeah, he goes, but then later, like, well, this is a smoke-filled room. I don't want anything to do with it. I mean, look, every candidate, you as well as I know, back when they were doing their slating, they want the endorsement.
Sure they do. Sure they do. And there's advantages to that, of course. You have committeemen and throughout the city and suburbs with organization that know how to get the vote out, and that's Joe Barros's advantage going into this election. He's got some of the committeemen like Jesse White and Mike Madigan, et cetera, who have strong organizations and can get out the vote. And the progressives are constantly trying to fashion sort of ad hoc grassroots organizations to do that work. So it'll be a real test of the ground game.
Yeah, and that's, quite frankly, that's where we're, despite all of the TV ads and everything that are flooding your TV set and the mailers and the mailbox, I mean, we're down right now to the ground game, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that develops in the Cook County Assessor's race. Hal Dardick, my good friend and colleague, the Chicago Tribune, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning. And,
thanks for having me.
It's not like we haven't had any long days lately, right?
Right. Hopefully not that many more to come, but we'll see.
That's right. The sun will come out tomorrow. Thanks, Hal, so much.
Thank you.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this special pre-primary edition of the Sunday Spin. Everyone's still trying to fathom Donald Trump's decision to meet with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Now, he'd be the first president to do so, and a lot of people are speculating, well, that's probably why he said he would do it. But there's still doubts whether this meeting will ever come off. There's a website called Now This News, and the folks there did a comparison of how Fox News covered Barack Obama when he talked about potentially meeting with U.S. foes, and Fox News's coverage of Trump's decision to speak to North Korea. Now, we're going to play a cut of the comparison, but note how when you hear scary music, that's when they're talking about Barack Obama, and then when you hear the patriotic music, that's when they're talking about Donald Trump.
Would you, as president, meet with the leaders of a country like North Korea? Obama extraordinarily said, I'd meet with him.
Senator Obama made his intentions crystal clear on the campaign trail.
I will meet not just with our friends, but with our enemies.
President Obama likes talking to dictators.
He would meet with some of these madmen without any preconditions.
You know, I'm going to reach out to these crazy people around the world and try to get things done.
Yeah.
I think that's a mistake.
Obama is bowing and scraping before dictators. What is Team Obama doing? Establishing formal contacts with these people.
A remarkable turnaround in relations between two historic adversaries.
The commander-in-chief's leadership is now leading to a major foreign policy breakthrough.
Another stunning Donald Trump breakthrough.
President Trump scoring a big win.
It's time to celebrate a great victory when it happens.
President Trump proves the experts wrong again and scores a stunning diplomatic triumph.
Stunning diplomatic triumph. That's the news you get, right? That's our news today. Well, joining me now here in the studio as we kick off our special pre-election roundtable is my good friend Bob Sector, former colleague, now director of investigations at the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney, the lead quote in my Sunday story about the Trump factor in Tuesday's voting. He's a political scientist at the University of Illinois and with the university's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Gentlemen, thank you so much for getting up with me this morning.
Morning.
I know how rough it was after your revelry yesterday on St. Patrick's.
I was
going to
say, you're assuming there was a getting up before we came in.
He's Irish, I'm not.
Well, gentlemen, just to start out, we got a question on the text line, and someone got what appears to be a newspaper in the mail, called Prairie State Wire. And the headline in this purported newspaper says, Rauner's shift to the left draws challenge from Oz. And the question was, could you, Rick, address this? It came to the House, and it appears to be an Ives ad. Bob Sector?
And it was an Ives ad. What you've got there is a piece of propaganda put out by a Illinois zone Steve Bannon, without the six shirts, I guess. But a guy named Dan Proft, who will essentially do anything and say anything for money. And he backs a lot of causes on the far right, and sometimes not on the far right, but he will say and do pretty much anything, and he's got this chain of faux newspapers which make their appearance in hard copy around election time and appear to, they pretend to be newspapers, but they're propaganda.
And back candidates that he has a financial stake in.
Yes.
Yeah, primarily downstate, I think. And the most, there's like the Shambana Sun and the Springfield Daily Blob or whatever. I forget what they call them, but yeah, different ones. And they kind of get this hyper local look to them. One might say this is completely deceptive, and they're trying to put out information that's clearly slanted as, in the guise of, a legitimate media. And I think that's what most people in the media would say, and probably most people in the United States would say right now. But I think he will harken back and say, look, the media back in the day, you should have seen what they were saying about Thomas Jefferson. They were all political rags. Well, for the last 100 years, I think that's not been the tradition in American journalism, as we lead the world in expressing unbiased opinions and so forth.
Well, there's propaganda, and then there's journalism, and not that there isn't bias in journalism, and I've always said, objectivity is a goal, it's not a science, and the best I can get you is my attempt to be fair.
Yeah. Well, the line, unfortunately, the line is being blurred all the time.
Well, we just heard that. We just heard the Fox News.
Yeah, with Fox News and a whole bunch of websites and TV and radio
and
operations.
Social media.
And Sinclair, the big chain that is trying to buy WGN and other television stations, and apparently this radio station, where they require the anchors to read propaganda. So
it's the state of our world today.
Yes.
It is the state of our world today. Well, let's talk about Jeannie Ives and Bruce Rauner. Jeannie Ives, the three-term Republican state representative, far-right conservative from Wheaton, who decided to take on Bruce Rauner. All of this kind of a couple of factors at play here. One is the falling out of conservatives with Rauner after he signed the bill that would expand taxpayer-subsidized abortion coverage to poor women and women who are covered by state employee health insurance. And it seems like we're trying to see what lane is Bruce Rauner traveling in here. He signs that, which ostensibly would be viewed positively by moderate suburban women, Republican-leaning women in the suburbs, who are a very key demographic in statewide politics, signs that bill. Then, just the other day, a bill that would require the licensing of gun dealers in the state, state licensing of gun dealers in the state, a fallout of repeated mass gun tragedies, including Parkland, Florida, and he vetoes that bill and tries to nuance it that, well, it's anti-business. Now, you would think those same moderate suburban women, many of whom are ostensibly parents of school-aged children, would be supportive of that bill. Is that a sign that he's worried about Jeannie Ives?
Yes, and he's showing it day in and day out. I mean, he a few months ago, he was not running ads against Jeannie Ives. Now, that's pretty much all he's running. I think we've said this before on the show, that his problem is that he has no base anymore. As the Republican Party has tacked to the right, and he's been sort of all over the place, and she's kind of sucked the oxygen out of, you know, of that group of people. And there aren't a lot of good polls out there to tell us where this is, but where this race stands. But the fact that he is actually paying an awful lot of attention to her suggests that he is quite worried.
What do you think, Chris?
Well, I mean, in some sense, to me, the analog to this Republican primary this year is, it's 24 years ago, and I'm an old man now, so I'll probably get some of these details wrong. But 1994, when Edgar was running against Jack Roser. So you've got a guy named Jack Roser who was, it was kind of a mix between a Dan Proft and an Eline, in that he had his own money, but he was also the sort of
auto engineering in Carpentersville.
Yeah.
And he was very successful businessman, but very much to the right.
Very much in the right, funded a lot of right-wing candidates, and then in 94 he runs because Jim Edgar, as a moderate Republican, pro-choice and so forth, violated the values of the right wing, and so they got pissed off, and he ran himself rather than bankrolling somebody else to run. And the reason that that's an interesting comparison is you've got basically the same kind of Republican, you know, the rump right wing of the Republican taken off against an incumbent Republican. But the big difference is that Jim Edgar was very popular in 1994, and Bruce Rauner is very unpopular in 2018, both with Democrats, of course, but also with Republicans. And I think what we're going to end up seeing, potentially, is even though we have this very different contest, we're going to see the same result. That Jeannie Ives is going to get, 35, maybe 40% of the vote, maybe 30, who knows. And Rauner, the more moderate candidate, is going to win. But the difference, I think, in this case is that Rauner has, again, whether it's strategic or just random or just following his nose, he's kind of running in different directions on these things that you just mentioned. And so one time comes in the general election, whoever he's going to run against has plenty of things to choose from to batter him with in commercials.
We're speaking with Bob Sector, Director of Investigations with the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney, Political Scientist with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue by Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association, and Chris Mooney, Political Scientist at the University of Illinois. We were talking about the governor's race on the Republican side, and we'll get back to that and the Democratic side, but we've got a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yes, good morning, Rick, and to your guests. I want to get you all's opinion on two races. I can't really call the attorney general race. One thing about Pat Quinn, he's a great campaigner, maybe a better campaigner than all this holder. So I wanted to maybe get some input from that. But also, the most fascinating race to me is in the first district for the county board. With Brandon Johnson getting support from the teachers union and Tony Preckwinkle against Boykin, who's receiving backing from these pro-business packs. I think that's a fascinating and ramifications also for that race. So maybe I'll just comment on those two. Thanks, guys.
Sure, Ron. Thank you. Let's talk about the Democratic ballot for attorney general. Eight candidates running. A huge number of undecided. I think everybody accepts that. And then you've got the former governor of the state of Illinois seeking another chance to get a government paycheck, seeking an office, seeking an office that is one of the few he hasn't sought before on a statewide basis. And then you've got Kwame Raoul, state mm-hmm. senator, who is the Cook County Democrat-endorsed candidate. You've got Sharon Fairley that used to that had headed up these kind of civilian oversight issues at the, over the police. A number of candidates here, Jesse Ruiz.
Nancy Rotering.
Nancy Rotering, Mayor Highland Park.
Scott Drury,
who mm-hmm. didn't vote for Mike Madigan to be speaker, Aaron Goldstein, and Renato Mariotti. I think we got
it.
Them all.
You
okay,
it, really?
And we've had seven of
Bingo.
Them. We had seven of the eight on the show. Mm-hmm. The only one who didn't come was the one Ron mentioned, the former governor of the state of Illinois. Did not.
That's
come
surprising.
On the show.
I, you know, it's rare to see an open microphone that does not attract, you know,
well,
somebody
and
himself.
Plus the guy who's known for having the Sunday press conference,
right.
You would think,
yeah.
on a Sunday morning.
I think Ron answered his own question in his question when he said he's a much better campaigner than he is an office holder.
Well, yeah, but when you've got a big, I mean, you know, big primaries are just completely not completely unpredictable. They're very unpredictable, and this was one where, I mean, you figure you've got eight people in the race, you could win with 14% of the vote if the split's right. I mean, you know, some people remember back, was it like 96, 98, Jesse Ventura, a pro wrestler from the state of Minnesota, runs on a third-party ticket and wins with 36% of the vote. So, I mean, crazy things can happen. And you would think in this, and Quinn probably very smartly walks in. He's the most recognizable person in that field. People walk in the voting booth, you know, they're going to go in there to vote for governor, maybe a member of Congress, and then they look at the attorney general. I guess it's something to do with attorney, and there may be some military component to this. So, Pat Quinn, I heard of that name, so maybe I'll vote for him. So that's a great advantage for Quinn. On the other hand, the candidate I think that you mentioned who got the county party support, Kwame Raoul, also has another advantage in this situation, is that he is one of only two African Americans in the pool, and appears to be the one with the most money and most recognition, and the most obviously, you know, sort of African American name or name that could be African American, which is important when voters are reading the ballot. And they look at that and they say, well, this guy is, you know, Lipinski, I'm Polish, I like a Polish guy, so, I'm, you know, this guy's Kwame Raoul, okay. I think
that's why all the judges are Irish.
You know? Irish, yeah, Polish, right. You know, yeah. Whatever. Whatever
including
works, what works in that
right.
sub-district, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Quinn does have name recognition.
That's part in the big
if you're one of the candidates on the statewide ballot, like Susana Mendoza or whatever, do you want to be on a ticket with Pat Quinn in November?
Well, nobody seems to be saying. I mean, no. I don't see a lot. Well, there's this anti-Quinn ad that's come out.
Well, Nancy Rotering has run one. I believe Scott Drury has run one, saying that.
Yes.
Mike Madigan wants Pat Quinn.
No, but
I'd
of
be
course
very surprised if that's the case.
Well, he apparently wants.
Well, he wants Jeannie.
Yeah, he thinks that's his favorite Republican too. You know, but yeah, I mean, the opponents are going to attack. I mean, of course they're going to do that. But if you're suggesting that maybe the powers that be would rather not see Quinn, on he's not the one they want.
Well, Cook County Democratic Organization,
right.
they did not endorse Quinn.
Yeah,
and
well,
I think that was a signal. But I think that also was a signal that they don't want to be on the ticket.
Well, of course. And what you would like is a balanced ticket, and one that's got, you know, various representation of various perspectives, and it would be much more, I think, a much more balanced ticket for the Democrats. They would like to see an African-American person running for attorney general. That would probably help them in turnout. They can use that in turnout in the fall
Well, and especially ostensibly, you've got on the Republican side, Erica Harold, former Miss America, used that scholarship money to go to Harvard and, and get her law degree. Gary Grasso, DuPage County board member, former Burr Ridge Village manager, runner backing, obviously, Erica Harold here, African American woman, has a great presence. You know, quite frankly, if you're going into politics, being Miss America ain't a bad thing because you're always out talking to people and giving, you know, public speaking and that kind of thing. So, you know, yeah, there is a African American factor for the Democrats to consider here as well. We're speaking with Bob Sector from the BGA and Chris Mooney from the U of I. I'm Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, joined here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in historic Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue by Bob Sector, Director of Investigations with the Better Government Association, and Christopher Mooney, political scientist with the University of Illinois and its Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Gentlemen, we had talked earlier about Bruce Rauner. We had talked about the gun bill. Last week when he was in Chicago, Governor Rauner repeatedly dodged reporters' questions when asked if he was going to sign this legislation that would license gun dealers, legislation pushed by the mayor, all 50 aldermen, whether he would sign it. He dodged the reporters here in Chicago. But the next day, speaking to a downstate radio station, WJPF, downstate, a more gun-friendly region, Rauner announced he'd veto it.
So we've been doing a lot of homework, doing a lot of research on this, and I have decided that I am vetoing that bill. I'm going to veto the bill. It's just not right. It's unnecessary, burdensome regulation. It's redundant on top of existing federal regulations. It's crushing to our small business owners and creates bureaucracy that really doesn't help keep our communities safer. I am going to veto that gun store bill that got sent to my desk.
Okay, that's Governor Rauner. Now, he gave his rationale. He could have given that rationale the day earlier in Chicago, right?
Yes, and apparently he doesn't think that anything that happens downstate gets upstate. So it's a little bit bizarre, but I think the one thing that Bruce Rauner has said consistently since he first ran for governor, which has rung true, is that he's no politician. And he just, you know, we've seen a guy who over the last year has been utterly rudderless, and which is why he has a political problem going into re-election. He's all over the place. He's tacking right and left and in and out. And so now he has a challenge from his right. And, you know, and this is also, if he survives that, he's that action is going to give him trouble on the left.
Well, and so let's talk about the race for governor on the Democratic side. And I kind of touched on this earlier when I was speaking with Hal Dardick about what's going on with the Cook County Assessor's race. But, you know, you go back not that many months ago, and here's J.B. Pritzker, billionaire heir to the Hyatt Hotels, going to self-fund his campaign. He's now at $69.5 million out of his pocket into his campaign for the primary, which is by far a state record of self-financing.
But of any financing, let's face it.
Wait, but you go back to that, and here's the guy. So you're a labor union or trial lawyers. It takes some of the pressure off of trying to fund a governor candidate. You can devote resources to legislative candidates, other races. He sews up kind of the establishment. And that was kind of viewed as a productive thing, except we have this wave of anti-establishment that is sweeping through politics on both sides, but in the Democratic primary. And so now, you know, you've got the top three Democrats, Chris Kennedy, the iconic heir of the Massachusetts political family. You've got State Senator Dan Biss from Evanston, who is trying to get the true progressive anti-establishment forces that were the Bernie Sanders supporters. This is coming down to the wire, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to, it's a little hard to poll on primaries, just like it's because people don't, it's harder for people to vote in primaries because in the general election, you know, everybody's got a party identification. They kind of lean one way or the other. So it makes it a lot easier to walk in. Yeah, I'm kind of a Democrat, so I vote for a Dem. You go in a primary and you got three Dems. What are you going to do about that? It means you have to think about it a little more. And, you know, he's got all that money. And that has helped him. He's put, you know, he's run these positive ads for months now. But what we're seeing with the polls is a very consistent sort of mid-30s for Pritzker, mid-upper teens for both Kennedy and Biss. And that really hasn't, I mean, you know, little up, little down. Polls have some random variation in it, and there's some talk about, you know, maybe Pritzker was kind of strategic in the way he applied some of his negative ads. When Kennedy started going up in the polls, he hits Kennedy. Biss starts going up in polls, hits Biss. Not too hard, because he wants to keep them both in there, because if they're not both in there, then it's a head-to-head, and then he's much more vulnerable.
Well, and so we have seen these negative ads that mm-hmm. he's run, but you know, analysis, he's spent $33.5 million Pritzker alone on TV advertising. In this race for governor, $65 million, almost $66 million worth of TV advertising. And you've got Governor Rauner, $16.5 million. As Bob Secker mentioned earlier, a lot of those were initially anti-Pritzker ads, but then now they've switched to anti-Jeannie Ives ads. But that's just the governor's race. You have everybody now flooding the airwaves, mm-hmm. as expected. Clutter. Does anything cut through?
It's tough at this point in a campaign, especially when you've got multiple campaigns running multiple, you know, offices. People are going to shut down to some extent, especially just on the sort of reactions to what's going on in the campaign commercials. Every single commercial you see, you're watching the basketball one after another. You know, give me a Axe body deodorant commercial, please. You know, you know, so it's a tough one. Something, you know, it is possible at the last minute for something spectacular to happen. I think in some ways, we'll see how it breaks, but the Tribune's done some exposés recently, really, in particular this one on Pritzker, 2 weeks ago now with his offshore. Boy, that's, you know, whether or not that had direct impact, if people read the article and really that's going to have an impact, but it's, I don't know about that, but I do know it's full of stuff you could use in negative ads, either now or in the fall.
Right, but you know, and with Pritzker, with like $33.5 million in advertising, is there an overkill factor?
Well, there's certainly a point of, you know, it's a diminishing return, it's a nonlinear effect. You know, the first dollar you spend, you're going to have a lot more effect than the millionth dollar you spend, right? Do people get sick of them? You know, if people got sick of running too many ads, McDonald's would have gone out of business. You know, so I mean, I don't know if that's the case, but there is a diminishing return effect on these things.
Now, there's a new Kennedy ad, which, quite frankly, I think is one of the most interesting ads of this campaign. And obviously, Kennedy trying to run as a legacy candidate in many respects. And it's a 1960 John F. Kennedy, his uncle, presidential campaign ad. But it's been photoshopped to take the word Kennedy for president and mm-hmm. change it to Kennedy for governor. It's all black and white mm-hmm. with the campaign theme song and pictures, you know, Kennedy.
Is this the one where they have Martin Sheen as the narrator?
No. This is a black and white old Kennedy campaign commercial, which I thought was very, because, and quite frankly, when I talked to some people about it, it's like, why didn't they run that earlier? If you're going to be all in as the Kennedy legacy, why wouldn't you do that earlier? I don't know.
Well, I think, you know, he's not, you know, like so many of the people we're seeing in this race, he's not a politician, you know, and, he, you know, maybe he didn't have the,
well,
the greatest
game plan.
Well, but you're
hiring people that you know politics.
Well, but you don't, maybe, I mean, the thing, you got to hire people that know what they're doing. I mean, the classic situation, and not that they don't, not that they don't know what they're doing in the Kennedy campaign, but what I'm saying is that, you know, just because you've got a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to win. And especially in Illinois politics, politics, that's been the case time and time again. You know, I tell my students that Barack Obama was president of the United States because of how Illinois treats these rich neophyte candidates. You know, you remember the name of Blair Hull, who famously punched his wife in the ankle in their divorce papers and was leading in the polls 10 days before the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate in 2004, and Barack Obama was third place. Divorce papers come out, boom, Obama's gets the nomination. The next time, you get Jack Ryan, who won the nomination for the Republican. Turns out he's trying to take his wife to a sex club, and people are trying to figure out what a sex club is, and that kind of leaves us with Alan Key. So we don't treat them very well. Bruce Rauner's the first one who's kind of survived.
Oh, Peter Fitzgerald.
Yeah, but he was in the Senate first, so I kind of, state Senate. So he was rich, but he also was running in a particularly weird race, and, you know, against Carol's Mosley Braun. As opposed to other states, I mean, the governor of Florida is one of these guys, the governor of Massachusetts, and the governor of Massachusetts is one of these guys. He's a Republican, and he is well-liked in a very Democrat, more Democratic states than Illinois. So it shows you that, you know, you can be successful. It's just that ours has not been.
We're speaking with Chris Mooney, political scientist at the U of I, and Bob Sector, director of investigations at the BGA. I'm Rick Pearson. This is your Sunday Spin. Back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Bob Sector of the BGA, you had a point about the governor's race.
Yeah, well, if things break the way it appears they may break, we're going to have the an all tax avoidance general election with Rauner, who we thought 4 years ago had perfected new and interesting ways to avoid paying taxes, but now we've got both Kennedy, who has figured out how to both criticize the tax system in Cook County and lower his taxes by hiring a notorious tax fixer. And you've got J.B. Pritzker, who I can't even understand what his argument is about how he didn't avoid taxes in the Bahamas, because it literally makes no sense. But, yes, he did avoid taxes. And so the likelihood is you're going to have people running for governor in the general election asking to be the person to manage your taxes and get the state out of the mess, who have a long track record of leveraging elite tax breaks that you and I don't get.
And so, Chris, how does that relate for the average voter? I mean,
well,
which has been kind of a question that's been in the background.
What the voters think?
Well, no, about no. As far as well, no, as far as the wealthier candidates and relating to the average voter.
Well, the key concern in every election is discrimination among the candidates. You know, the candidates look to discriminate themselves from the other people. How am I different than that person in a positive way? And how are they different than me in a negative way? If both candidates have this problem, they can't discriminate themselves against it, and each are inoculated. Even if one's a lot worse than the other in some way, who knows which? It's too complicated to explain. You're a tax cheat, I'm a tax cheat. Fine, let's move on. That's
mutual assured structural.
We'll call it a draw.
That's right.
Real quickly, guys, the Illinois 3rd Congressional District, Southwest Side, Southwest Suburbs, 7-term Congressman Democrat Dan Lipinski, a Blue Dog Democrat, I guess you would say, Marie Newman, the challenger. Here again, another kind of, to me, a symbol of the taking on the establishment.
Yep, one of the most conservative Democrats in Congress, and now one of the most endangered ones as we move, again, in more and more polarized society where people in the middle get targeted in the primaries by people on the fringes. I'm not to say that one's on the fringe here, but that's happening on both sides, both parties, and that's one of the symptoms
of the bases having to play to the far extreme.
Sure, except now you've got the example, though, in Pittsburgh, of the Democrat who's more like Lipinski being successful in this runoff or in the special election.
Except that, but that was a special general election, not a primary election. And of course, you know, the party establishment always favors traditionally the incumbent.
That Pennsylvania district was a much more conservative district than the third is, and especially the third has been evolving.
Well, and to me, that's I think what this question is of what is that suburban district, you know, and there's been a Lipinski representing it for decades.
Yeah, but you know, I think there's implications beyond the third. If Marie Newman can win in the Democratic race in the third over Dan Lipinski in the general election, if I were Peter Roskam in DuPage County, I'd be scared because he's already got problems, and that shows that the whole area is becoming more and more Democratic and more liberal.
Well, as I pointed out several times, you know, in that last general election mm-hmm. for president, Hillary Clinton won the collar counties mm-hmm. except for McHenry.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Roskam's district, mm-hmm. she won that. And the suburbs are starting to look like a real big problem for Republicans. Evidence
all
of
over
that,
the country.
Yeah. And evidence of that in that special election, which was a suburban Pittsburgh.
Sure. And we haven't
and
even
Alabama
talked about
as well with Roy Moore. That's he won in the prime.
We haven't even talked about the Trump factor, which is also going to help Democrats in the suburbs.
No, but you can read about that on the front page of your Chicago Tribune.
Can I?
Really? That is my story. What a great segue there. Bob Sector, Director of Investigations for the Better Government Association. Christopher Mooney, political scientist at the University of Illinois. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. And it'll be great to have you back next Sunday when we'll spend 90 minutes going over all of the elections.
How wrong we were.
There you go.
Couldn't have happened any other way. I'm good at that.